This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Jennifer Roberts becomes the first Charlotte mayor in 30 years to be voted out of office. Vi Lyles beats her in the primary. Some surprising changes in the makeup of Charlotte City Council are coming, too, because of Tuesday's primary. We avoid a direct hit from the most powerful hurricane ever, but Irma still leaves a mark on the Carolinas. And though Charlotte says it should be Amazon's prime location for a new headquarters, the New York Times rules us out. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom. Nick Oxner is an investigative reporter for WBTV News.
Hello.
Hello. Are you on my side this morning?
Yes,
okay. Always.
And Doss Helms is back this week from the Charlotte Observer. Good morning to you. And Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, is also here.
You can morning.
Good morning. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. And you can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. That's not our adoring fans thanking us for the Facebook Live broadcast. That's the crowd at Vi Lyles' campaign headquarters on Tuesday night, as she was declared the winner in the Democratic primary for mayor. Her defeat of Mayor Roberts has been described as stunning. Was it really that unexpected? Who should I start with? Eric.
Oh, well, looky there. Me. Yeah, I think if nothing else, it has to be surprising because there's no runoff. I think that a lot of people were coming into this looking at it as the Democrats would have two people facing off in October, and then we would figure out who's in the general election. And instead, Vi Lyles, who was, I think, the third highest in money raised, so it's not all about money, dispatches Jennifer Roberts in the first round.
Well, so I was going to ask what happened. We spent a lot of time talking in the weeks leading up to this about how Vi Lyles and maybe State Senator Joel Ford would split the African-American vote, thereby giving it to Mayor Roberts, or at least making it a squeaker and a runoff. What happened to that split vote? He didn't do well at all.
It didn't split.
No, right. In fact, every single precinct in the city, and there's this great map the Board of Elections puts out where you can kind of track overall voters' preferences citywide. Every precinct went either to Lyles or to Jennifer Roberts, or it was a tie. Mm-hmm. Joel Ford came in a distant third in this race. Vi Lyles started the night at, 47% of the early vote? Jennifer Roberts had—
It never moved.
Yeah, 36, no. And he had 15.
Did he just not connect, or are people in Charlotte as mad at the legislature as they are seemingly at us?
I don't think it was the legislature. I don't think many people, you know— This is a problem, and Dan Clodfelter can testify this, is that when you go off to Raleigh, boy, you go off to Raleigh, and people in Charlotte just really aren't very attuned to what you're up to. But the interesting thing, I think, about Senator Ford's campaign is that he did a lot of the heavy lifting for Vi Lyles because he just attacked and attacked and attacked Jennifer Roberts on HB2 and on the response to the Keith Scott shooting, and I do think that had some impact.
Well, and that may have really helped Vi Lyles, too.
Yes.
And here's the thing that you have to remember. Vi Lyles and Jennifer Roberts have already been elected citywide. Joel Ford is elected in a district, and that district is a small subset of Charlotte. Yeah, he went on the offensive, and he threw a lot of political elbows and landed some punches, apparently, again, for Vi Lyles. But he never introduced himself to a wider audience in the city. The people in his district know him. The rest of Charlotte did not, and that showed up.
Well, I think there's another problem here that Joel Ford had, too, is I know that his people thought he was going to raise, you know, between $400,000 and $500,000. He didn't raise that much money. And that becomes even more important if you don't have a sophisticated ground game to increase the turnout. You know, Vi Lyles, clearly, she didn't go on television, and it's very rare in any kind of political race to have someone who's on TV lose handily like Jennifer Roberts did. Jennifer Roberts had TV ads, to someone who's not on television. So that means that Vi Lyles, she raised more money than I think a lot of people thought she would. But she also had to campaign the old-fashioned.
It's also always about who gets out to the polls, this relatively small slice of people who voted in the Democratic primary. And she was well-known among that group. And if you liked Jennifer Roberts' values but weren't thrilled about the way she handled things, mm-hmm. and there were a lot, you know, there were people who were mad from both sides of how she handled the police situation during the Keith Scott shooting. There were people mad on both sides of HB2. you could pretty easily segue from Jennifer Roberts to Vi Lyles.
It's not a big jump.
I know that, Nick, that you work for the money printing press called Television. WBTV.
I'm not familiar with that money.
But, yeah, they keep it for themselves. I've been there. I know.
I appreciate the shout-out to printing presses of any kind. That's always good.
But could it be that even though Jennifer Roberts spent all this money on television, that's not effective as much anymore because people zip through the commercials?
Well, no, it is very, very much. I mean, seriously, not just because I'm on
television. Slow down. This is my livelihood.
Yeah, that's right. Not just because I'm on television, but it is still the best, you know, it's the easiest way to reach the largest number of people.
It's true.
That being said, you know, I think Jennifer Roberts' problem is that she had a core base of supporters and she couldn't get more people than that. And Tom apparently agrees with that because that was such a well –
I do, actually. And here's the thing. Like, if you look at the numbers, Jennifer Roberts won the mayor's race with 36% of the vote against Dan Klotfelter. This Tuesday, she came in with 36% of the vote.
Yeah.
The
problem, I see what you did there.
The problem here for Jennifer Roberts was simple. There was a motivated base that, you know, didn't either switched or just more people voted, obviously, for Vi Lyles. And the reasons for that motivation are always interesting.
Well, and that would have been a great base had Joel Ford taken more votes away from Vi Lyles, would have been enough to get in a runoff with someone, and then you could maybe win that. But because Vi Lyles was able to just dominate the kind of pool of voters that she was competing with Joel Ford for, that really was not a good strategy, a winning strategy for Roberts.
So this – go ahead.
We've talked a lot over the weeks about the role of the Black Political Caucus and whether their endorsement meant anything. And, you know, you can always argue cause and effect versus just picking the candidates who are going to win. But their candidates won, and Vi Lyles was one of them. And, if again, in a relatively small turnout – if they're managing to get votes out in a way they have not in the past, then they stand to play a much.
Wasn't it something like nine of their candidates?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Some of them were in a runoff, but no one lost. Yeah. No,
and the Observer also endorsed Vi Lyles. Do you think that played a role? I mean, they came down pretty heavy on Mayor Roberts.
Yeah, and again, with endorsements, you always get the question of, is it driving votes or is it simply reflecting the reality of what's out there? The difference with the Observer is that we're not trying to take people to the polls or anything. We're offering an opinion. And when I say we, of course, it's the editorial board and not the news staff. But the Black Political Caucus, part of what they want to deliver is not just an informed opinion, but an informed opinion that comes with voters going to the polls.
Just real quick, Mike, despite all the change in this vote, one thing that really surprises me is that the actual turnout went down from 2015. And you would think with what's happened.
It was 8%, wasn't it?
7.95.
7.9, and it was 8.8 last time in 2015. I mean, you would just think with all of these issues, particularly the two that keep coming up, HB2 and the Scott shooting, that people would have been really, really motivated to vote.
What does 7.95% equate to in terms of raw?
Like 43,000 people, something like
43,000 people. So this is a change election decided by 43,000 of Charlotte's
not
eligible
voters.
Not enough
to fill Bank of America Stadium.
Exactly.
And we've had a lot of the council races being decided by under 500 votes. In one case, 13 votes, I think.
And with this election, no matter what happens in November, it means that Charlotte will have its sixth different mayor in 3 years. Anthony Fox left to join the Obama administration. Patsy Kinsey filled in. Patrick Cannon was then elected. He went to prison. Dan Klotfelter came from Raleigh to fill in. He ran. He lost to Jennifer Roberts. Now she's lost to Vi Lyles. I was going to say this sounds like whiplash, but it actually sounds, Anne, more like the school superintendents coming and going.
Makes you long for the days of Pat McCrory,
doesn't it? Last a little longer. Yeah. It does make you wonder, though, are we done with these days of people like Pat McCrory and Harvey Gantt and Sue Myrick, where the mayor kind of became synonymous with the city?
Yeah.
And now it really is kind of, you know, check your calendar, who's the mayor today?
Wow. Roberts has had a really tough 2 years in office. It stemmed from the riots, of course, last year, next week. Following the Keith Scott shooting, to the city bathroom ordinance that led to HB2. She was a proponent of that, but she did not back down in defense of her actions, particularly when it came to that ordinance.
You know, 3 years ago, people weren't talking about transgender individuals. People didn't realize that they were discriminated against. They weren't included. Now, there is compassion, there is inclusion, and this campaign helped that happen. And I do not apologize for standing up against discrimination.
I don't know that I've ever heard a politician talk about that issue. And she stood up for LGBT rights for her 2 years in office. Who stands up for those folks now?
By Lyles, I would assume. I mean, the votes were not all that different, I don't think. Is there a huge difference on policy?
Well, she was willing to sacrifice the bathroom portion of the ordinance. So there's a little bit of difference. I think the main difference is what you just pointed to, which is that Jennifer Roberts made so much of her political life about that issue. And Vi Lyles, while she is supportive of LGBT rights, she's not going to be nearly as forthright.
And that's what I think won Vi Lyles this contest, right, is when you are out of work, when you don't have a secure place to live, when you're worried about the crime rate, the thing you don't care about as your number one issue is LGBT rights.
So you're saying this is a Hillary Clinton all over again?
You said it. I think that
when she writes her book, she can call it What Happened. In her concession speech, Jennifer Roberts talked about her race against Lyles and how they both kept things positive. And Lyles, in her acceptance speech, had nice things to say about Jennifer Roberts.
It has been exceptional, the work that she has done. But even though the voters said to her that it's time for new leadership, we have to acknowledge what she's done in the past and be grateful.
Now, if you just read those words off a piece of paper, it would look like boilerplate acceptance speech, you know, tipping the hat to your hard-fought contest and your opponent. But coming from her mouth, those words sound very genuine.
Well, and I think that's what makes her strong as a candidate. I think, and I think Nick was getting to this point, is there's a comfort and an ease about just Vi Lyles as a person. And when you put that with her extensive experience in city government, remember she worked 30 years behind the scenes, I think those things really strengthened her in kind of a quiet way, though. I mean, a lot of people, again, I certainly didn't see this coming, where she would end up with 47% in the primary, but it certainly resonated with the voters who did come out.
Yeah, I truly believe that she can connect with voters in a way that Jennifer Roberts couldn't. Jennifer Roberts, at times, I think it's fair to say, could come across as aloof, whereas Vi Lyles seems more personable. But here's the trick. Her campaign, this primary campaign that, yes, was successful against Jennifer Roberts, is about to go up against a very different kind of campaign. You know, Jennifer Roberts and Vi Lyles were very careful, very cordial with each other because they both walked the same path in city government side by side. Kenny Smith, who is won the Republican nomination easily with, 88% of the vote, he will come out with an attack ad. He will come out and he will be a much more visceral opponent than Jennifer Roberts or Vi Lyles were to each other.
And yet on election night, after the results were known, Kenny Smith was still talking about Jennifer Roberts.
We think we're the candidate that has a vision for the city. We think we're the candidate who has the record furthest from Jennifer Roberts. And we think we're the candidate that has the leadership skill set necessary to implement the long-term vision this city needs.
Now, I think it was Jim Morrill in The Observer, I think it was Jim, who wrote the column about Jennifer Roberts making things very difficult for Kenny Smith in the fall, well, in November, because of Vi Lyles taking Jennifer Roberts' place. Why does he think that?
Well, clearly there was, I think he referred to it as Jennifer fatigue, that there are people who are frustrated, again, sometimes from many different perspectives with decisions she's made in the last 2 years. Kenny Smith was ready to just wail on those and, you know, and get the discontent from all angles. Vi Lyles, you know, she's been part of city government. She does have a record, but she doesn't have those negatives, I don't think, that Jennifer has.
There's another thing, too. Kenny Smith can easily run as the candidate of change against an incumbent mayor. Well, Vi Lyles has now unseated that incumbent mayor, so she, even though she's following the same policies, that's going to take some of that candidate of change out of Kenny Smith's sails. He will argue that they are very much the same candidate, but it does take out a bit of that.
There were other races in that primary on Tuesday that we'll come back and talk about in a moment, and we'll get to other issues as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Dilworth Home Tour, presenting the 44th annual home tour today and tomorrow. The tour includes 7 houses that range from historical residences to new homes. Info at dilworthonline.org. And NC Warren, presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. NCWarren.org. Next week marks a year since the Keith Lamont Scott shooting and the ensuing protests and riots that shook this city to its core. So we wanted to get the impressions of some of the leaders who were at the center of that event and to hear about what they learned. Various WFAE reporters talked to CMPD Chief Kerr Putney, a city council candidate, a current member of council, the mayor, and to a young person who brought everything into focus. That's on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the trail of Irma, Trump and tax reform, Equifax outrage, Hillary opens the book on her failed campaign. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines, and that's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues next hour with On Point, following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins. You're on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Ann Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Nick Oxner from WBTV News and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Before we move on from the mayor's race, do Democratic voters think they're getting something substantially different from Jennifer Roberts? Did they want something substantially different from Jennifer Roberts? Or do they just want a change because Jennifer Roberts has been characterized as being polarizing? We don't need any more polarization in our lives.
Wow, that's a lot of questions to unpack. Yeah,
I'm known for that.
Yes. And who is the voice of all the Democratic voters here?
Well, clearly they wanted a change, right? I mean, you don't get the number that Vi Lyles got in a primary without – that's an overwhelming sign
yep.
that people want change. Why they wanted that change, to answer the other 10 of your questions, we don't know.
It's only an hour show. I got to pack it all in.
We'll be done at noon.
So what about money? Because this was a big money race.
Oh, yeah.
And it didn't seem to play a role at all in terms of affecting the outcome.
I wonder about the role of social media, which is low cost or free. And Vi Lyles, I almost was ready to unfriend Vi Lyles from Instagram just because I would get so many. You know, you would every time you would log on, there's Vi at this event and that event and this event. And people like Braxton Winston, who were very savvy about using social media, probably also had some paid campaigning. But those were people who were doing well.
But the money was huge on the Democratic side. Yeah. It was significant. I mean, I don't have the pure raw numbers from the 2009, the most expensive mayor's race in Charlotte's history. But it was about $1.2 million thereabouts. Before like primary day even hit, we were already just shy, $8,000 shy, if I remember right, of $1.3 million raised. And the prior record was for the entire election. And the funny thing to me is there's an efficiency that a lot of
But remember, Tom, you were only talking about two candidates in 2009. I mean, that's really it was Fox and Laster.
Still, I mean, when you look at the third tier candidate in terms of money raising, or I guess the fourth if you count Kenny Smith in there too, Joel Ford raised almost $250,000 before the primary. Like, that's significant.
Oh, and Vi Lyles raised just about
around 300.
I wouldn't say that money didn't play a role because money definitely played a role, and I'm not sure that anyone expected Vi Lyles to raise the hundreds of thousands of dollars that she ended up raising. I think that was a shock, and I don't think had she not raised that much money, she would not have been the contender that she turned out to be.
What role do you think politeness played in all this? Because the barbs that were being exchanged were between Mayor Roberts and Joel Ford, and Vi Lyles was able to pretty much be nice. She never criticized Roberts really till the very end, and then only mildly. No one was paying attention to her. Joel Ford wasn't really paying attention to her, not throwing barbs at her. But so she came off as nice.
But apparently,
did that play a role in this?
Apparently somebody was paying attention to her because they went out and voted for her. So
yeah, the standard rap was that there wasn't a lot of energy around her.
Right. I mean,
I think that missed the mark.
It did miss the mark because I think I heard that a lot, not just among media people, but you know, out and about. And her message did resonate. I think the other thing that was really helpful for her is her personality. So she did not campaign as a different person, which happens so often to people in races.
So getting back to the money for just a second before we move on to city council races, I mean, she didn't raise as much as Jennifer Roberts, and Roberts raised a lot from outside sources who were probably supporting her based on the discrimination around HB2 and the city ordinance. And Kenny Smith probably raised a lot of money based on that same thing to get her out. Well, now we have Vi Lyles. And she's starting this November campaign at a deficit compared to Kenny Smith.
Significant deficit.
Where will her money come? And will she need money?
Well, if you wrote checks to Jennifer Roberts and Jennifer Roberts lost, and now you're looking, we can either have Vi Lyles or Kenny Smith. All those people wrote checks, or a lot of those people wrote checks to Jennifer Roberts, are going to quickly write a check to Vi Lyles.
And that's the thing. I mean, again, they're policy points. They're slight differences. I don't want to make them sound like Jennifer Roberts and Vi Lyles are clones. But they're similar enough that she's going to be able to raise the money there. There's also the optics involved of the mayor who became known nationally, Jennifer Roberts, for standing up for LGBT rights. If she is voted out in a primary and then a Republican takes over, you know, the floor or the mayor's office on the 15th floor, that is a huge optic problem for, you know, people on that side of the of this issue. So they're going to work really hard to get her elected.
I think it's going to be really interesting to see sort of the attacks from both sides, what Vi Lyles goes after with Kenny Smith and how Kenny approaches her, because, as you say, I mean, they're pretty similar issue-wise, but their personalities are so different. And it's just going to be interesting to see how he tries to approach that, because he can't go at it as head-on as he would have with Jennifer.
He'll look like a bully if he goes after Vi Lyles.
And the other thing you have to do here, and it goes to this bully point, is just as I was talking about with Joel Ford, Kenny Smith was elected to city council from a district. His district knows him well. Republicans in the city know him well. But he has to focus on the unaffiliated or somewhat independent voters, and he needs to introduce himself and show them where he stands on the issues and define himself to those voters. If he does not do that early, if he does not do it before Vi Lyles' campaign does, he's going to be playing catch up, and the money won't matter as much, because he has to be able to say, I'm going to focus on right here in Charlotte, and that's what's most important.
But that's where the money comes in, right? Thankfully, luckily for him and the Charlotte TV stations, that's where all that money comes in, because the best way to start introducing yourself to people are TV ads, Facebook ads, and mailers, right? Yep. And so you're going to start seeing those probably soon from Kenny Smith, because he has the cash, and I'm sure more cash will be coming to do that.
Well, there were also some surprises in city council races. Two longtime incumbents, Patsy Kinsey and Claire Fallon, lost. So let's start with District 1, where Patsy Kinsey lost a seat that she's held for 12 years to a newcomer, a first-time candidate, Larkin Eggleston. I promise to learn his name. Larkin Eggleston, who said that she was out of touch. Very much like me, evidently. Was she, or was this just voters in a district with a lot of newcomers, young newcomers, saying, let's bring in youth?
Well, I think Tom has really dug into this district race in particular, so.
Aw, shucks. I think it's both. And Patsy Kinsey's actually been on the city council for 14 years. She was elected in 2003. And she is as well entrenched a Democratic incumbent as you could find on the Charlotte City Council. You know, she, as you listed off all the mayors that we had, she was one of the mayors. But District 1 has changed hugely over that time. It's, you know, lots of unaffiliated voters coming in, lots of millennial potential voters coming in, lots of new people trying to see exactly what it is.
Because that's Dilworth, Sedgefield, and Plaza Midwood.
Yep, and it's even bigger than that. And this Plaza Midwood in particular, I mean, if you talk about District 1 as a whole, it really is like Charlotte in a nutshell, because besides those neighborhoods, you've also got neighborhoods like Cherry, mm-hmm. where gentrification is a significant issue, where people are getting, you know, priced out of the homes that they or their families have lived in for decades and decades.
And Eggleston really went after her on a decision that she made on council with regard to the Van Landingham estate. Is that what did her in? Because she took Dilworth and Sedgefield, but she lost Plaza Midwood. Is that what did her in?
Well, I will argue that it is certainly a significant factor, because Plaza Midwood is the largest precinct in District 1, one of the largest in the city. So that was a big deal, especially since I don't remember the exact vote totals, but I think both together were less than 6,000 votes.
It was 437 votes difference between them.
So. And you're talking –
that's a perfect example of what you're talking about earlier, just a handful of people deciding.
But, you know, this is it's like 2,500 homes in Plaza Midwood alone. But in fairness, Eggleston didn't just win Plaza Midwood. He won other districts or other precincts as well. And so he obviously had a broader appeal than simply the Van Landingham estate issue.
And this is one where there's no Republican contender either,
so
right?
He has won
a seat. We now have a new millennial candidate.
You must learn his name.
I will, because he actually called me personally at home. I don't answer the phone if I don't recognize the number.
Stay off his lawn.
And you know you get, and it's right, and you know that you get a lot of roof.
That's why I can never reach you. Oh, he doesn't answer.
Anyway, you get a lot of robocalls in advance of an election, and he called, and he was live on the phone.
Yeah.
He was live on the phone. I mean, he must have called everybody who voted for him.
And again,
in a low turnout
election, that could be the
thing that was amazing to me that you'd actually be live on the phone. Meanwhile, 83-year-old Claire Fallon was ousted by not finishing in the top four in the at-large contest. She was one of the most independent members of city council. She sometimes voted with Republicans on council. What does her failure to get enough votes in this primary signal?
She didn't, you know, her campaign was an oddity to me. I think part of it is there. This is one of the things I was watching about this campaign in particular. Millennial voters, potential millennial voters, are huge here in this city. They're the fastest growing demographic. Most of them are unaffiliated. Where are they going to break in primaries? And then a separate question is with the general election. And if you look at the people who did make it on the Democratic ticket, and there were no Republican primaries because there are only three Republicans running for at large. But you have Smudgy Mitchell, who is an incumbent, and then he was the top vote getter, and then Braxton Winston was second, followed by Julie Eisolt, mm-hmm. and Braxton Winston, another millennial, followed by Julie Eisolt, who's an incumbent, followed then by Dimple Ajmera, who was appointed, but was running for her first election technically, and she's also a millennial. I think Fallon placed sixth out of those four. And I think part of it was there really has been this millennial push into local elections that a lot of people didn't know if it was going to happen or not. I'm not saying it's huge, but it happened enough that you have millennial candidates that are driving, you know, that they're driving their way to the city council.
And I think the contrast to me between Braxton Winston and Claire Fallon drives that home. We talked about narrow gaps. There were 6,600 votes between Braxton Winston, who's 34 years old, never held public office. A year ago, I don't think any of us at this table knew who he was.
He's a protester.
Yeah, he kind of emerged. Well, he's more than a protester. Yes. He's a very well-educated person who has a broad range. But he was an unknown a year ago. And then you have Claire Fallon. What is she, 83, I think?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, again, part of that sort of political establishment. And, boy, the voters went for Braxton.
And didn't Claire Fallon, didn't she first come into office on the Anthony Fox wave?
Yeah, 2011.
But it kind of became something that just perpetuated itself because she never really ran, you know, the traditional campaign.
No, and I think it had always done well enough for her that she didn't really need to. But as the resident millennial in this room, the only millennial in this room, right? Yeah. I'm going to reject
Get off my lawn.
I'm going to reject. I don't think it's correct to characterize, the millennial wave. I think we have candidates who are new with fresh ideas, with a lot of energy and momentum, but not because they're millennials, because of the issues. You know, Braxton Winston came in as a protester in the wake of the Keith Lamont Scott shooting. That's why he was well-known.
And he bested Julie Eisolt, who was also
the top vote getter last time.
And she was front and center during those protests. She had a lot of things to
say. Absolutely. And I'm just going to go back to clarify my comment about millennials. I don't think they're voting for other millennials because they are millennials. What I'm getting at is I think that the millennial candidates found ways to connect that other millennials were paying attention to.
I think it's because they were energized. I think Braxton Winston and Dimple Ajmera, to a different extent, both have their own constituencies that are issues that are important to the community, but not because
I'm sorry, Nick, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but does anyone know what percentage of millennials voted? Because traditionally, the younger voters don't vote.
I was going to say, it seems to me that the younger candidates must be connecting with some of the older voters.
Exactly.
As well.
So,
or turning out the motivated younger voters.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's talk about Dimple Ajmera for a second, because she was appointed to fill the seat of
John Autry,
who went to the legislature, and she's in a district seat. I think district five, I think.
Currently.
And she ran in this election at large, which is the whole city, and she came in fourth. Is that because of some of the controversial things that she has said that people agree with, or simply that gave her notoriety and got her noticed?
Yeah, I think it gave her enough name ID. She also has a unique name, so you remember it. And so I think she was also towards the top of the ballot.
If it's alphabetical,
and a big part of this is this was a primary.
Right.
And primaries tend to cater towards the more ideological side of whatever party you're voting in. And, you know, an interesting question, I've been scratching my head on this. I do not know the answer, but I'll posit it out there just for fun. Did the controversies that she's gone through or caused. Did it boost her enough to get her in that fourth place seat, or did it knock her down to that fourth place seat?
I think it boosted her enough to get her in the fourth place seat, which was a fine strategy at name ID out there, but I don't think it's going to help her in the general
election. So in the general election, we've just elected four Democrats to run at large, selected to run at large. How many do we get to pick in November?
Well, then
is
we
one seat, two
nope,
seats,
no,
four seats,
four.
But there are
four
three Republicans who did not have a primary, but
so you
who
have
will
a
be
field
on
of seven.
Election.
One of whom is a pretty strong contender in John Powell, who
I think Parker Kane narrowly missed last time.
That's
right. The other thing is we look at the council races. It's interesting, Smudgy Mitchell, because last time he was hanging by a thread. So he did something this time around differently because he was
in favor of soccer.
Well, no, but here's the thing. I would only caution
get
that.
Your kicks.
I would only caution that statement by reminding you this is a primary.
No.
And you're comparing it to the general election.
That's
I'm
true.
Curious
That's
to
true.
See what happens there because you're right. That's John true. Powell lost out to him by, 400 votes and change?
Yes.
Not much.
Now, on the morning after the primary, Tom, you were on this program with Michael Dickerson, it runs the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Elections, and there was a question about a possible recount in one city council district and a runoff on October the 10th in another. Has that been settled yet? What are we doing now?
I do not know if the recount has been
Monday, isn't it? I think they're meeting Monday.
So I guess that's when they will officially do it. But it's a 13-vote difference. Of course there's going to be a recount. If there wasn't, it's only because the second-place candidate says, don't worry about it, I'm not really that interested.
And that's District 2 between Justin Harlow and Jatanya Adams, who I believe are both new candidates,
That's
right?
correct.
Okay. Although states of emergency were declared in both North and South Carolina prior to Hurricane Irma's arrival, we here in Charlotte dodged a bullet for the most part.
This is the ocean now. These are ocean waves coming in.
Woo! That's the sound, with a little amateur commentary, of water breaching the seawall on Charleston's Battery. That water flooded the area from the seawall to about a mile into their downtown. Several people lost their lives in South Carolina as well. And a large number of people in this state lost power. Has that power been restored?
Yes, in North Carolina.
It's amazing to me, having gone through Hugo and having been out of power here in Charlotte for 18 days during Hugo, that people in Florida, they say that by the end of next week they'll have their power back. It's the entire state was out of power almost. How are they working so fast down there?
Well, they sent crews from literally up and down the East Coast.
Well, they did that here too.
Well, but they were ready for it, right? I imagine in Charlotte during Hugo, the infrastructure is just not made to withstand a hurricane all the time. When Florida, they deal with hurricanes regularly.
And I don't know how much of this is water versus wind. In Charlotte, we had so many trees that were down and that had to be cut away, and so Florida may have had more problem with flooding than it did with wind.
So in the Carolinas, was the damage that we did receive, and there was damage, was it mostly from wind? Mm-hmm. Was it from flooding?
No, wind.
Yeah, the flooding actually didn't materialize as much as people were worried that it would, not even out in the mountains as much. I mean, I remember everybody was watching rivers near Asheville to see if they were going to hit flood stage. We were fortunate. They didn't.
So Irma's
still
gone.
Are chunks of the Blue Ridge Parkway that are have trees down across them and rocks that slid. I think the rain loosened roots and got some things sliding, but it didn't necessarily flood.
So we only have 20 seconds left, but Irma's gone. Now Jose is still out there. It's 445 miles, I think, east of the Bahamas with 75-mile-per-hour winds this morning. So is that a concern, or is it going to track off to the
No, its current track from the National Hurricane Center is going to brush the Outer Banks and the east coast of North Carolina about Tuesday.
And it's not even a hurricane.
Right? Oh, it is
just
a hurricane.
Barely
a
hurricane.
And it's going to continue to strengthen over warm waters between now and Tuesday.
And do we have school Monday? That's all I need to
know. I'll give you a message now.
No, stop. We're going to talk about that in a second. Okay. Stop. We have to break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's like herding cats in here. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeast Digestive Health Center. The practice has expanded to help support the growing community. A second location at Edison Square in Concord is now open and ready to serve patients' GI needs. More info at northeastdigestive.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting the 20th anniversary production of Rent, the story of seven artists struggling to follow their dreams without selling out. September 26th through October 1st at Belk Theater, 704-372-1000. Hurricane Irma cuts a path of destruction across Florida. President Trump makes deals with Democrats. Equifax opens the door again to identity thieves. And Hillary Clinton revisits her failed presidential campaign in a new book. Those are just some of the stories they'll be talking about as the News Roundup continues nationally and internationally during On Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock with Tom Ashbrook. And we are coming back in just a moment.
Startup incubators have become something of a tired tradition, but this one might be a little bit different.
We want to attract people here that want to create the green revolution, not just come to Hollywood and make the next big movie hit.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the future of clean tech. Startups next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg.
That guy over there.
Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal and Andos
New to town.
From the Charlotte Observer. And CMS generally is used to closing or delaying the start of school because of a single flake of snow coming down. We don't deal with many hurricanes, but does that explain the system's flip-flop this week on opening, not opening, delaying, not delaying?
You know, I've never gotten a good full explanation. They tend to send bits of information by email, but basically what happened was on Monday when most of us went home from work, it really looked like a fizzle. There was nothing but a little bit of rain and a few gusts. And it did start picking up after dark, after things. So apparently what I don't understand is why they sent out their first, they call it Connect 5, but it's these automated messages that go to phones and texts and all that. And it said, everything's on schedule. And they started sending that out a little before 8 o'clock. And then at 8 o'clock, they had this meeting with emergency officials in which they said, you know, we're starting to see trees coming down. We're starting to see power outages. There were, in fact, several schools that were without power that next morning.
Right.
So somewhere around 9:30, they posted on social media a two-hour delay. And because they have, I think, 190,000 subscribers to that automated system, there was sort of this role of people getting the everything all clear, go ahead, normal schedule. And then they're, you know, hitting their Facebook app and they're seeing, Oh, wait, two-hour delay. So there was a lot of confusion. There were people who did go out to the bus stop at the normal time and had neighbors coming out and saying, oh, wait, didn't you know about the two-hour delay? So
meanwhile, schools in York, Chester, Lancaster, and Chesterfield counties in South Carolina decided to cancel classes completely on Monday because of what was then Tropical Storm Irma and its path. Channel 9 reported that some parents felt that the threat of severe weather wasn't strong enough to warrant that cancellation. Did they prove to be correct, or is it simply better to err on the side of caution? Or do you even know about this because it's not CMS?
I was going to say, I don't know much about the weather in those counties.
I would actually like to see.
What about the money? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
There's a real actual reason about this that we reported.
Okay.
Not me. But
and your channel what?
We're channel 3.
Thank you. All right.
On your side.
That's right. So in South Carolina, they have regulations that if the wind is over 30 miles an hour that day, you can't operate the school bus. And
really?
So, I mean, we did get wind gusts up to that and more than that. And so they couldn't operate their buses. And so we actually, some parents, you know, like in Union County, North Carolina, right, kind of there in the southern part of that along the South Carolina line, were asking, well, why are our kids going if the kids in South Carolina aren't? Is it safe for kids?
Different laws.
And that is really the nature of this, that in a lot of these weather instances, the vast majority of people are not going to see anything bad.
Right.
But if they have school as normal and something really bad happens, then people are going to be
That's how
really
you get
angry.
Nick Oxner doing an investigative story.
That's right.
So this week is 51 weeks after the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. Next week is the anniversary of it and the ensuing riots. Superior Court Judge Robert Irvin ordered the release by CMPD of surveillance video taken during the protests and riots. Who requested that release?
The Charlotte Observer.
And why did it take so long?
Well, we placed the request in late July and said, and I was not part of this request, so I don't know the exact wording, but basically said, give us all the video that you have of the disturbances. And the police department said, no, we're not going to. And besides, it's more than 78 hours. So,
but then I read that the CMPD did not oppose the release of the video.
Well, and again, this is this dynamic that we've talked about in several instances here in the past year since they've had this law that says video release unless it is clearly a public record, has to go through a court. And
no, it's just never a public record.
Yeah.
Now. Let's be very clear on what the General Assembly did and what Pat McCrory signed into law, calling it transparency, is that police video is absolutely secret. So even when the police department wants to release video, like
you
they
still have
many
to go
times,
to court.
Yes, and props to the Charlotte Observer for being aggressive enough.
Yeah,
but
again, the other part of the dynamic is we get the video, and whereas people think it's going to be like a TV show where you will see this, you know, close up of a guy pulling out a gun, I think most of us have watched that video over and over and said, is this the video evidence of Raekwon Boram shooting Justin Carr? Because what you see is crowds milling around.
Let's back up. The Observer wanted this video released because they thought that would help clear up the mystery of who shot Justin Carr. Is that correct?
Well, one of the things they had said was that they have video evidence that points to Raekwon Boram. And as we know, that's been a point of contention since literally the second it happened. There were police saying it was a guy in the crowd, and there are people who still believe it was the police.
So Mecklenburg County prosecutors asked the judge to redact 2 minutes of that tape. Is that what they wanted to redact, whatever footage would have shown their...
I think probably, although I don't know for
was
sure.
Was it in fact redacted?
It was not redacted.
Okay. So Raekwon Boram is accused of killing Carr, and his attorney, Terry Sherrill, insists that the footage is still no smoking gun.
The video puts him there in the area of the Omni at or about the time that Justin Carr was shot, just like a whole lot of other folk were, including the police.
So now this video comes from, what, traffic cameras and security cameras? Is that where it comes from?
I think so. It was clearly being manually operated. It wasn't just pointed somewhere because you were seeing it zoom in sometimes when things start happening. But zoom in is a relative thing. If the part that we saw was the only evidence they have, I'd have a hard time imagining that would be viewed as evidence. I don't know that what we have is all that the prosecutors
have. It does not show the shooting itself?
You see a flash. What we eventually got his attorney to sit down with us and say, this is what the prosecutors told us. And so what you see is this, I mean, I'm not even sure.
Tiny speck of light, really.
Yeah, I mean, there were people with cell phones out. There were, you know, walk signs flashing on and off. So there's a tiny flash. You see people run. One of the people who steps off the curb, who's moving with that crowd, is a black man in a white T-shirt who moves his hand around his waist. Apparently what they're saying is that is Raekwon Boram fleeing the scene with his gun. Again, I would not get that from that. His attorney does say that he was there and that he had a gun, and I believe that he fired it.
He said that.
So
Raekwon Boram fired
the
gun.
Again, the video that we have is sure not a persuasive, you know, smoking gun is an unfortunate term in this case. But
so more to come on that. Amazon, the online retailing behemoth, is searching for a second home, a second headquarters, and Charlotte thinks it is a prime location, and it is set to deliver. It is set to deliver its bona fides to the company. They are aggressively pursuing landing this $5 billion campus with 50,000 jobs, and Governor Roy Cooper is also on board.
It is a company that could make a real difference in a transformative way of our economic landscape. So we will be putting together a package. We will be selling our state. We're the place for them.
So he's apparently talking about North Carolina at large. We're talking about Charlotte.
Yes.
The rest of the state, you know, they can just go someplace else. You've seen the proposal. Is that right, Tom?
I've got it right here in front of me.
This is from Amazon.
This is Amazon's
letter. It to us.
What are they looking for, pray tell?
Well,
cash.
That's it. I mean, that's the short of it. You know, they do a lot.
Handle our hopes.
They do a lot of nice things here as I flip through it. You know, they establish the fact that it's, you know, potentially a $5 billion investment, potentially 50,000 jobs at an average salary of $100,000.
More than $100,000.
Wow.
They say average salary of $100,000. So that is a nice little plum get. Then they go through all of this like a couple of paragraphs talking about how they, Amazon, are a city builder, that, you know, they, how much money they've pumped into Seattle's economy over the last few years, about how important this will be. Basically, it's like, look, we're the bright, shiny thing. And then they go through, you know, some real basic points. They want a metropolitan area with more than a million people, a stable business-friendly environment, urban or suburban locations with the potential to attract strong talent, and, you know, communities that think creatively when it comes to real estate and things. And that's just shorthand for—
places that are nice to live.
Well, but the last one is a shorthand for what I think is the most important here, which is incentives. Yeah. Land, building.
I am shocked.
Whatever it is.
Shocked.
But 50,000 jobs paying $100,000 or more can make a significant, it would seem to me, difference in the city.
Yes, I think that's safe to say.
Oh, not just for the city. This would register very easily in the state's GDP.
Yeah.
This, where if this project comes to fruition and if it lives up to the billing, it is one of the more significant economic development things happening in the United States.
So the New York Times took notice of this, and they made a list of 50 cities that might be attractive, given the parameters that you just read.
Wait, and there are some more. But
might be attractive to Amazon, and the Charlotte Regional Partnership and Charlotte Chamber both issued a joint statement saying we will aggressively pursue this opportunity, but it could be transformative change. So the Times put together this list of 50 possible cities and then began to eliminate them based on certain things, and they cut us. Because we rank low on cultural edginess that attracts young, educated workers. Instead, they choose Denver for this to happen. Now, we've heard this before, that we lack edginess. And it seems to me that as we continue to develop these suburbs, for the very people who are looking for edginess, we are wiping out the very edginess that they are looking for.
I think they got that part. The good news is Charlotte made it pretty far down in the cuts before we got cut.
Yeah.
And we got cut on cultural edginess, which I think is crap. I mean,
it's silly.
The people who are making the decision, you know,
Mike
incentives versus cultural
edginess. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Mike, all you have to do is invite them to Charlotte Squawks. Yes. It'll be fine.
There we go.
We'll go year-round.
Yeah, you could solve it.
But it's... Are people making $100,000 looking for edginess?
Well, here's the – sure. Some – you bet. If you're a 23-year-old programmer with a $100,000 salary, you're going to want some good nightlife. But here's the bigger point. I found the New York Times story to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with Nick. I think their elimination of Charlotte – and this is not for personal reasons. The elimination of Charlotte is just – it was a little hinky. Denver, the pick of Denver, totally ignores a simple fact. The whole concept of a second headquarters
is East Coast
and traffic
is to have it so that you are in different regions.
Right. Mm-hmm.
As someone who grew up in the Mountain West, whose sister lives in Denver, I can tell you it's a wonderful place.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between the Mountain West and the Pacific Northwest is not much. The difference between the East Coast and West Coast is significant and powerful.
Well, that's the whole – I mean, just the basic point here is that the business strategy is to have an East Coast and a West Coast hub. So Denver's not going to work. Despite their edginess, that's probably not a fit.
Okay. So let's move back to schools for a second. 35 public schools in Charlotte earned the state's top grade for student achievement, but 10 Charlotte schools were among the state's 98 F schools. Where are the winners and where are the losers, Ann?
They're where they always are. The A-plus schools are the ones that serve generally the more affluent students and or that have selective magnet admission policies that are just magnet programs that draw high-performing students.
And
the Fs are almost always the high-poverty, resegregated schools that have been struggling for a very long time.
And you also reported this week that these latest ratings show how small and how slow progress has been at CMS schools that have been targeted for help. And are these scores telling us anything substantially different from what we heard when Project Lift released their own assessment a little while ago?
Well, I think every batch of data, and I have to admit I'm like this too, I'm sort of like Charlie Brown. I get disappointed every time I see that the same neighborhoods, the same schools, the same groups of students are still performing very poorly on these tests. And so we have to ask, if the tests are really showing us what we hope they are, which is, are these kids getting the skills that they need to succeed, then that's a major problem. And I think people have been trying hard, people in these Project Lift schools and Beacon schools. I don't think they're just, phoning it in. I think they're working really hard with kids who have a lot of challenges.
But we've also talked in the past about how these grades of schools are not necessarily reflective of reality on the ground. We have talked about that.
No, and Dr. Wilcox, Clayton Wilcox, the superintendent, was at an event yesterday. And, of course, that was one of the first things that somebody in the audience asked him was about these schools. And he said, yes, the scores are not what they ought to be, but, boy, we really want to see – arts and we want to see caring adults. And he said, if you want those scores, cut all the other extras and we will do nothing but drill on reading and math, right, and you'll get the scores you want, but will you get the results you want?
You also wrote that while Ardrey Kell and Rocky River both have graduation rates well over 90%, college readiness exams show that most students from Ardrey Kell qualify for admission to UNC schools, while only 24% from Rocky River do. And that, you say, calls into question the meaning of a CMS diploma. What is the meaning of a diploma when that's the case?
That's a huge question that's in front of everybody. I think it's probably always better to have a diploma than to be a dropout, but we've celebrated with some good cause these rising graduation rates. They've risen for all racial categories. They've risen for economically disadvantaged students. But if you're getting a diploma, and again, if the test scores show us, and I always want to put that asterisk, but if the test scores show us what we think they do, mm-hmm, they're not graduating with some of the skills that they would need to be successful in the next step.
And before we go off the schools, we must talk about the Charmeconator.
We must.
Yes.
Pray tell, what is that?
Mm. Well, that's what a lot of parents were asking when they checked this week's menu and saw the Charmeconator listed with no explanation. It is sort of a meatloaf-ish sandwich with lots of cheese sprinkled in it and a ketchup-y sauce baked on, served up on a whole grain bun.
It sounds like a low-grade McRib.
Yeah. Jeez.
So parents had one resounding question, right?
Where is the beef?
There you go.
The second bad joke you've made this hour, Mike.
Yeah, it's funny. The reaction to this has been so strong one way or the other. It's either what is this disgusting junk and why did they not know it was a bad idea to serve it to our kids, or I'd eat that.
I love the quote you got from the nutritionist who said, well, yeah, but it's on a whole wheat bun.
And it's not any worse than a cheeseburger.
Right, right.
So I saw the
not any better either.
Kevin Sayers cartoon this morning, and I had no idea what it was about. I just thought it was about the salaries that he was paying people.
I think he had merged two bits of epic reporting there.
A big bite.
Nicely done.
Unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time, and we can neither talk about Hornets returning in pinstripes and pleats next year. Just when you thought pleats were gone, they're back with the Hornets at least, because next year they'll be allowed. They're one of, what, 8 teams allowed to wear the classic uniforms next year. I'm not sure why that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. and although Alexander Julian, and they'll have the classic old logo, the old B on the thing, but Alexander Julian designed them, but they're going to be they're going to be Jordan branded.
Yes.
What's up with that?
Well, I think the guy who owns the team has some influence over that.
Okay. And we don't get to talk about the South Carolina mayor getting caught.
Can I make my joke about the Hornets really quickly?
Yeah.
Perhaps since we're doing, vintage stuff, they can make a vintage run to the playoffs.
Looky there.
Hey, Tom Bullock, Nick Oxner, Andos Helms, Eric Spanberg. The comedy continues. Later.